author and broadcaster Scott Simon, Hemingway historian Robert Elder, and live music in Studio 435 with Lily Kay. Now, here's your host, a man who has a stain on his shirt from the last time he wore it, Justin Kaufman.
That's a style. That's a Kaufman go-to. You know, you get a little mustard on it. Just wear it until someone calls out and you go, oh, it just happened. Oh, you're not going to believe it's like 15 minutes ago alone. And you just keep going on and on and on. I should get my own show on HGTV. The Stain Lifter. Something like that. It's a good, I have done that in the past where I had a shirt where there was a, I really liked the shirt, but there was a stain and it was right on the, right about chest level, right on the front there. And it was obviously some sort of food stain from a lunch. And I did make the call. I was like, you know what, I'm going to go with it until called out. It had to, essentially you were called out a second time by the same person. Then it would be, then it's up, you know, then the scam is down, you know, it's over. But if you keep going and someone goes, oh, you got something, I'm like, yeah, I know, lunch. What can you do? Can't go home between. Yeah, that's, there you go. Fashion advice from Justin.
You do have a working, I know you've had trouble in the past with washers and dryers.
Yes,
you
I have a working one. Okay. Now. Yeah, it is nice. I went to One Fun, the Chinese place in the West Loop on Saturday. Great place. We had Austin in here. We were talking about not too long ago. And I came out of there, and I was such a good meal. You know, a couple drinks. The next day, one of my fave shirts has a nice little Sichuan stain.
Yeah, it's a prime dripping spot.
Yeah, so I just had to figure out what to do. So if you see that this week, Pete, right, I wear that shirt tomorrow, and there's a stain, and I say, oh, that's from lunch. So you're not going to believe what happened to me. Then you know,
I won't say anything, but I'll know. We'll acknowledge each other silently.
Anyone watching the webcam, if you see the stain on the shirt, you know, be advised, it's a scam. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Ready to kick off this week. Excited to be here on a Monday. And we got a great lineup of programs. It's this feeling on Monday. It's, you know, everyone, like I was telling Ro and Anna, they have the case of the Mondays and the midday or morning show. But, you know, for us, you know, our Mondays are over as well. But it's exciting to have a Monday night show because you feel like that's the kickoff. We got a great one. And tonight, it's great. Scott Simon's going to be here as my guest at the big table, a longtime Peabody Award-winning journalist. He's the host of NPR's Weekend Edition. He has a book out, his eighth. It's a love story. It's called My Cubs. It's about growing up in Chicago and having Cubs in his family. We'll talk to him about what it means to be a Chicago Cubs fan, but more importantly, with all this World Series and everything that happened in the last year, how it changes the sort of his persona, how it changes the way that he views the world based on how he was a Cubs fan with all the lovable loser and everything that goes in between. So we'll talk with Scott Simon coming up at the big table tonight. I'm excited to have him here. I haven't seen him in a long time. I knew him from previous life. So it's nice to have him around. We can talk about his book. It's great. Also tonight, Jacob Meister's in for Dave Lundy. Chris Roebling will be here. We'll do Touche. Lots to talk about. Sally Yates in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Also talk about health care and what's going to happen with the Senate. And, of course, the French elections. That's coming up in Touche. The 9 o'clock hour, Rob Elder's back. Rob came in last year with his book about hidden Hemingway, just really exploring the Hemingway archives in Oak Park. They've unearthed a brand new love letter. Yep, never seen before. Someone came forward. I'll let Rob explain the mystery. But someone came forward and said, hey, you know, Hemingway was writing my mom when she was a teenager. You want to see the letters? Yeah, it was like a World War, like, correspondence. Ernest Hemingway unearthed lost letters, love letters, tonight. We'll read some of it. How great is that, huh? Also, the web series Chapstick, getting ready for season two. And Lily Kay, jazz R&B performer, live with her band in Studio 435 tonight. So excited for that. She's great. Can't wait to have her perform here on beautiful Michigan Avenue. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. This is The Download, 720 WGN. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got a big show tonight, so let's get to it. It's carryout. Here today's top stories, the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee finally had someone say yes to their invitation to testify in the ongoing investigation of all things Russia. Former interim Attorney General Sally Yates told the committee that she warned the Trump administration that former NSA Director Michael Flynn was lying and possibly compromised. A week later, she was fired. 2 weeks after that, Flynn resigned. It was sort of thought that Yates was fired for stepping out on the travel ban, but that might not be the case. There's that story, but then Trump tweeted out that someone should ask Yates under oath if she leaked info to the paper. She was asked. She denied it. Now, here we are again. The basic core of this whole story seems to be which is worse, lying and covering up or telling people about lying and covering up. That seems to be how the White House is playing it, not only with Yates, but earlier with the wiretap tweet about Obama. How about this? Can we all agree that both are bad? Is that possible to do? I'm okay with that compromise. We good? Everyone good? America good? I think we're good. Also, NBC News reporting that 2 days after the election, Obama warned Trump about Flynn, told him not to hire him. To Trump's defense, Obama probably had a long list of people that Trump shouldn't have hired, like a toilet paper roll that kind of like unfurled. The EPA got rid of nearly half the scientists that served on advisory boards this weekend to help with the agency. They help with the agency with policy and research. Some on the left say this is an order to silence science. And I get that's a concern since these are advisors. But the little thing in this story that doesn't make the lead is that there are term limits on these positions. 2 terms, which most of them were already up. So instead of changing that, letting them come back, the EPA said, nah, we're good. We'll find new ones. Mainstream media. Come on. It seemed like the EPA was coming in like, round up all the scientists. I'd like to talk to them. No, they're vacated. Former Illinois Governor Pat Quinn got his official portrait today. It looks good. Went with the purple striped tie, but I was hoping for a red hat maybe. Slew of newspapers under his arm, maybe a clipboard for signing petitions. Manual hand-crank lawnmower by his side and a couple of guys from IDOT that no one sent. All in the portrait. That would have been better. I guess this one will do. A new U of I study says that many of the sleep apps that are becoming popular to help out insomnia and other sleep-related trouble just don't work. What? Some do and some don't. So I thought I'd try them out in a new segment I'm calling the Download Sleep Report. Okay, let's try the first one here. Yeah, no effect whatsoever. All right, let's go ahead and try this other one. It's relaxing. Nope, no effect. Not really doing anything. Guess we'll do this third one, but I don't see it's going to work. Oh, what time is it? How long have I been out? 4 days? All right, that third one worked. The Download Sleep Report. It's Tourism Week in Chicago, and it was released today that over 1 million more people visited Illinois last year than the year before. How much you want to bet that at least 900,000 of them were just in town for Game 4 of the World Series? Take that away, and all you got is a few stragglers who came in to watch the 10 o'clock news be doing live on State Street. Jerry Taft, we love you. We're from Missouri. No. In weather, nice, crisp, late March day. So much fleece wandering around Chicago these days, right? I mean, it's May 8th. We need to at least add 15 more degrees. Am I right? Am I right? I think I'm right. In sports, the Cubs and Sox both got swept over the weekend, albeit the Cubs did it in spectacular fashion. Last night, the team battled for 18 innings. Only to lose, but it was an awesome game, just for the sole reason that they scored 3 off Chapman in the 9th to force extras. How sweet was that? And Schwarber made a tumbling catch down the left field line, and all the starting pitchers pinch hit and struck out, and the game actually broke the Major League Baseball record for K's. But in the end, the Cubs did lose, but let's be honest, this would feel a lot different if this were the old Cubs, always finding ways to lose. Instead, we're like, oh, Cubs are awesome. 18 innings, so awesome. Although they may have paid the price for the comeback, Chapman hit Anthony Rizzo with a 99-mile-per-hour fastball. He stayed in the game, but he was in noticeable pain. X-rays came back negative. I think he's going to play tonight, but still, scary. The Sox didn't have any drama, just got swept out of Baltimore with relative ease. Not good for a squad that really hasn't played outside the AL Central. They get out on the road, and boom, Orioled. Another questionable outing for Jose Quintana, who's been hot cold this year. And now the question becomes, how fast can we get Moncada up to the bigs? May 14th is the first day you can call up a kid without the whole year counting against you thing. Come on, Sox, do it. Come on, do it. Do it. Do it. Do it. Do it. The Bears signed veteran linebacker Dan Scuda to a one-year deal. Played with the 49ers when Vic Fangio was a D coordinator there. But some say this might be telling because injured linebacker Danny Trevathan may not be ready for the opener. He tore up his knee towards the end of last year, and it's pretty serious, so that's not good. The Nashville Predators beat the Blues over the weekend, so they await Edmonton-Anaheim for a Western Conference final showdown. Just keeping you up to date on where we'd be. The Hawks were still in it. Right about now, this is where we'd be. End of round two. And then the Bulls. Well, what are the Bulls doing? Talk of trade market for Jimmy Butler this summer. That's fun. That's a lot of fun. And finally tonight, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 won the weekend box office, won $134 million, and there was not just one Chicago song, but two classic 70s jams in the movie. So I think it's safe to say if you want to win weekend, if you want to win the weekend, Hollywood, try and shoehorn Lakeshore Drive into the soundtrack. Huh? That's why people come out, not for a baby tree played by Vin Diesel. Give me a break. Nobody likes Vin Diesel. That's the carryout for May 8th, 2017. Hey, Cinco de Mayo's over, but we got leftovers for every order. We're giving you a mushy avocado. You're welcome. All right. Coming up, Touche. Jacob Meister in for Dave Lundy. Chris Roebling will be here as well. We'll talk about Yates in Russia. Little healthcare and also the French elections. Touche coming up after the 7:30 news here on the download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martillo, how are you, my friend?
So you liked Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
It's good. It's good. It's got a strong, it's pretty strong. It's a good summer blockbuster.
We've got to get over the hurdle of number one, and then we'll go see it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, won't you give it? I mean, like any good blockbuster or sequel, it takes the same jokes from the first one and it just rearranges them. So it's like they loved it when this happened. So when the raccoon was surly, let's get surly again. You know, like it's that kind of thing. When he says, "I am Groot," and it's really a really long sentence, but it's just, "I am Groot." Oh, God, we loved it the first time. We love it the second time,
yeah,
too.
But I hear Baby Groot steals the show, though.
He does. They definitely make it a showcase for Baby Groot. So if you like baby trees.
You cannot sell enough lunchboxes with Baby Groot on it.
I know.
That's all I'm
saying. I love that it does say at the beginning, it says, and starring Vin Diesel as Baby Groot. But it's a baby voice, so it's like, "I am Groot." That's all he says. So I'm like, did they process Vin Diesel, like going, "I am Groot," and then they changed, like, well, what if we sped it up or something like that? Or did he go in and do a baby voice or what?
So basically, Vin Diesel's, whose acting talent is questionable at best, got paid a boatload of money to say, "I am Groot," for 2 hours.
He probably said it three times, and they just used it in three different ways.
Here's your check. Thanks for coming. Got to pay union scale.
He's like, I got to get over to the Fast and Furious.
He probably made 150 G's just for saying, "I am Groot."
There are two classic rock songs in
the
Chicago.
Man, I'm in the rock business.
So.
All right.
I think it should say Baby Groot by Rob Martyr.
I could do that.
Do it. Do an I am Groot for us.
I am Groot?
Done.
See?
Oh, we nailed it.
I just... said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
You go right. Touche! Monday night here on the download. Touche is in full effect tonight. Chris Roebling is here in for Dave Lundy. Jacob Meister.
Hey!
Thank you.
Lawyer, chairman of the Civil Rights Agenda, and a former candidate for U.S. Senate and a clerk of the Circuit Court. Jacob, thanks
Senate
for being here.
And clerk of the Circuit Court.
Double
it
trouble.
Works. It works for me.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, let's get to it, Chris. You guys ready?
Both of them good jobs.
Good jobs. Good jobs to have had. All right, let's get right to it. Today, the big news of the Senate Judiciary Committee finally has someone say
yes. I had it
yes.
on in the background.
You did. Sally Yates kind of gives a little bit of information in this testimony that conflicts with the Trump administration and possibly shines a little bit more light on the sort of, I guess, quote-unquote scandal of this thing.
Well, clearly there's a lot of stink on the Trump administration with Yates' testimony. I mean, even Lindsey Graham was highly critical. I think this is a story that we're going to see a lot of for a long time to come, and it doesn't look great for the Trump administration. You know, we're going to see a lot from Paul Manafort, Carter Page,
Who said thanks but no thanks in a more colorful way.
Roger Stone.
We'll see about that.
It couldn't happen to a nicer guy. Roger's been cruising for this bruising since I met him almost 40 years
ago. Do you agree with Jacob's assessment that we're going to hear about this story?
No, of course not. Jacob's all wrong about that. He got that all screwed up. There are two elements that Yates was brought in for. One is the Flynn conversation, and the other was the, you know, her personal rejection of the president's first executive order on immigration. And I will tell you, the Flynn thing was very illuminating. And I think that that is an area in which the Trump folks are going to have to, you know, figure out what the heck, how never to get into that kind of problem again. And very briefly, you know, having had the privilege of working in the intelligence field for a brief time, many thousands of years ago, what they worry about is compromise. And that is like from your entry on duty, your EOD, it is always about if you do something wrong, then you can be compromised and you can be coerced by the Soviets in those days, the Russians today. And so I give her credit and I give the DOJ credit for going to the White House and saying, this guy Flynn has got some issues. Okay, that's all terrific. And I thought that was really great. But on the other issue for which she was there, her ruling unconstitutional as first EO. And Jacob's the lawyer on this panel, not me. But she had no citation. She had no case. She had no authority. I mean, she had authority in her office. That she had the authority of her office. But she had no legal authority. She wasn't saying, oh, under Smith and Jones, 1901, I know that this EO is unconstitutional. All she said was, I didn't like it. And I had to do my job. And I think that that shows how fatuous and political. It was nakedly political. But, you know, she's a very articulate person. And I think that she acquitted herself well in that regard.
I mean, as far as the executive order goes, I mean,
what was her authority? What authority did she cite?
What authority did the president have? That's the question.
Well, he's the president of the United States. His job is to write the executive orders. And the Office of Legal Counsel found it to be conforming and constitutional.
Well, but he's not a dictator, and he doesn't make law. He enforces law, and you can't twist and turn by executive order what only Congress can do under certain circumstances. And in this one, you run seriously afoul of constitutional limitations. Well, this was a religious ban.
Can I say something?
It's not a religious ban. My son is in Jakarta, Indonesia, as we speak. It is the largest Muslim population country in the world, and it's nowhere near the EO. Saudi Arabia is nowhere near the EO.
But Chris, here's an issue, I think.
Afghanistan, nowhere near.
Of the two things that were brought up,
yes,
that one is one we want to know a little bit more. But I think we know that, yes, there were political reasons why she did not want
to. Well, she did it because she's an Obama holdover, and she wanted to throw sand in Trump's eye.
But I'm just saying, I think it's interesting that you choose that you want to talk about and not the stuff
about
Yates and Russia. I think it's not unlike with the Trump administration.
I started with Yates and Russia.
I know, but you said yes, but here's the big issue. But I don't know if that's that big of an issue because it really was. She got fired for it. She's out. There's no lawsuit or anything in there.
Well, she had the advantage in the conversation today of saying, you know, a couple of courts have agreed with me. And that's never
thing to say. Turning to the Flynn issues.
Flynn. Right? Let's go back to
turning
Flynn.
Turning to Flynn. I mean, she was very clear. Flynn. You know, the Russian efforts are clearly to undermine democracy. I mean, you've got Flynn on the payroll. Right. We now find out this weekend that the Trump family borrowed all the money for their golf courses from Russia. We have serious ties. We've got the dossier that comes out of the UK that shows that the Trump campaign itself was in the Ukraine meeting with, I think it was Ukraine.
And the only response from the Trump administration has been who told the press this?
The clapper response about the dossier was, we could not confirm the sources. There are only, you know, if there are 38 items in the dossier, about two or three are being taken seriously. But with respect to these other issues, look, I think that let's not forget, I left the Democratic Party in part because I lived in Finland and I realized that the Democrats didn't take Russia seriously back in 1972. So, I mean, I'm the one who's been serious about the Soviet Union then.
The Democratic Party?
That was
Finland
one reason.
And you were looking across, you're like, oh, man, Russia's going to be in trouble. I'm out.
That's another story, which I'm happy to tell some other time. But now I don't want to bore Jacob
table,
on that.
Right?
But the Democrats have come late to the concern about Russia game. But I want to tell you, every drop of this has got to be gotten out. It's got to be dug up by Congress through these committees, and they have got to publish a definitive statement about what the heck happened, and everybody's going to have to take a look at it.
Chris yeah. Roebling, Jacob Meister in studio. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Let's talk about health care, what's going to happen in the Senate. Also, we'll do a quick roundup on the French elections, a little debrief on that. It's touche.
Thank you.
Here on the Downloads.
Bien sûr.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
Chris Roebling, Jacob Meister in for Dave Lundy tonight. Touche. We're talking national politics. Chris, haven't had a chance to have you on since the healthcare vote came down last week. What do you think?
Big win for Trump. Big win for the House Republicans. This is a big coming of age moment for Paul Ryan, who desperately needed it. Now he's got to get 7 or 8 other legislative victories under his belt. Because he's been pretty, I would say, pretty sort of confused and sort of wandering around the halls of Congress. You know, I think that the bill that it's a vehicle. I don't agree with the folks who are wailing and gnashing their teeth. I think it's a pretty good start. But this is not legislating. You don't legislate. I had the privilege of working in Congress. You don't legislate until you get to the conference committee. I mean, what you're doing now is engaging the conversation.
Right.
And I think, if the Republicans had not gotten it together to pass something, then they would all be swept away. But as it is, they've got something
to talk
about. But
what's the danger in a bill that's not unpopular?
Well, first of all, it's not law. It's a disaster is for the Republicans. I think it's on the horizon. We saw the day after the vote, there were 20 Republican races that were downgraded, made it closer for the Democrats. I think the Democrats are going to make a lot of hay out of this. Let's face it. This is a disastrous health care bill for those, you know, they talk about, well, it provides access, but it makes health care unaffordable. It cuts $850 billion out of health care. The math won't work. You can't provide the health care to people. You cannot provide health care to people if you're cutting $850 billion out. Something's got to give somewhere. It's a lot of hocus pocus. And we're going to go to the Senate. The Senate is going to have one heck of a time. I mean, you already have Republicans, Susan Collins, Murkowski, Portman, Capito, all saying, whoa, wait a minute, we have problems with this. They should have problems with it because they don't want to suffer the same fate that a lot of their colleagues
are going to work that all out.
Are
they going to work that all behind closed doors because they want a united front of Republicans? They're going to come out and they're going to have the votes.
I think there's going to be a lot of work between now and the vote. I think there will be a vote. I think there will be a signing ceremony before the 4th of July recess. I think it would be better for the country if there was a signing ceremony before Memorial Day because of the cycle in the health care administration world, which basically June 1st is the start of their new year. I disagree with Jacob, and I would say respectfully, you know, Jacob is from the side that said, if you want your plan, you can keep your plan. If you want your doctor, you can keep your doctor. We're founding this program on the idiocy and the stupidity of the American people. And I think the Democrats have been wrong from the beginning on this issue. That's why they lost 900 seats in state legislatures. They lost the House. They lost the Senate. They lost the White House. Jacob himself lost. And you know, you've got to look at this thing and say, this is a profoundly unpopular program. And I disagree with the fundamental assertion that Jacob is making, that this is going to take health care and remove it from the realm of so many Americans. That is not in any respect the case. In fact, I think what they did, I mean, we are talking about Iowa with no provider. How is that access? How is that health care? What is health care? One final point. What is health care?
We've got the Republicans who cut off the funding to make Obamacare work, the
Affordable Care.
You change over the last 4 years. They refuse to fund. They refuse to fund the subsidies for the health care insurers. They refuse to fund. And right here in the state of Illinois, our co-op, Land of Lincoln, went under because the federal government cut off the subsidies that were supposed to go to make that a solid insurance
Jonathan
carrier.
Gruber,
We can repair Affordable Care Act. It's a very workable system. It's a plan. I'm on it. I love my health care. A lot of people love their health care. Yes, every Democrat will tell you we need to repair, but don't repeal and replace. Yeah. Repair it so that we can have health care that's affordable for everyone. What the Republicans are proposing rips health care away from 24 million people, and they say, well, everybody will have access, but it'll be access that will be so expensive.
This is not true.
It's out of reach. For most Americans to be able to afford, who have pre-existing conditions, to be able to
that
afford
is untrue.
It, we spend 16% of our GDP, and the next highest country in the world spends 9%. Something's wrong with our healthcare system. We got to fix it.
You know, I want to say that I think that Jacob is very earnest in his views. Okay, I think he's very sincere in being wrongheaded, and I grant him that. But the point here
you
is
say that with a smile.
When Jacob is standing up for a program where we are seeing increases in premiums of 25 to 116%, we're seeing deductibles that go to $7,500, deductibles that go to $10,000. You're talking about a practical limitation on access to care. So there are people out there with these care cards, and I don't think that the Democrats have it within them to care about the people who are not able to access the so-called health care that is behind that card. Why? Because those people are going to have a very hard time getting the $7,500 cold hard cash to put into the system so they can never get to any of the benefits. So the program that they came up with was fundamentally flawed, and Gruber, notwithstanding your passion just a moment ago, Jonathan Gruber himself personally in October said, quote, it is working precisely as we intended it to work. Okay, so you're saying it was all horrible because of the Republicans, and that's something we're used to hearing from Democrats. Jonathan Gruber, who is the guy who put it together based on the idiocy of the American people to be opaque and not tell them what they're doing, Gruber says it's working perfectly. And that was back in October. So you guys don't have your story straight.
It needs to be repaired. Every Democrat in Congress will tell you that.
Where is their bill? Who has sponsored that bill? You tell me a senator, a Democrat senator, who has put out a bill saying,
Democrat.
I'm the Democratic senator from Kentucky or wherever, and here is my bill to fix health care. Who's sponsoring that bill?
I think if they're asked to sit down and in a meaningful way, and there's a compromise bill that repairs it, they will be at the table. I can't tell you how many members of Congress I've talked to who hope that happens. They don't want this rammed down their throat, and they're not going to have anything
on right.
it.
All right. Let's move on. 1 minute. We got 1 minute on elections. That's all you get. 1 minute.
I think Macron is going to have to show by the people he recruits for these assembly elections all over France how committed he is to either reform or to stasis. And we're going to know, because the folks that he recruits are either going to be real reformers or they're going to be holdover elitists.
Do you see this as sort of a pushback on the sort of Trump referendum, the Brexit referendum
yes,
that we
yeah,
were seeing?
Yeah, I think there's a very similar divide going on in Europe where you've got the people who are disenfranchised, who long for what's in the past. You got a Macron who's in there saying we have to reform the economy. We need to keep the EU together, but we need to strengthen the EU. You know, fortunately, it happened because it's a horror to think what would happen if the EU came tumbling down. You know, Le Pen was a scary character as well.
Le Pen has gotten better. She's not there yet. She did a terrible job in the debate, which I watched. And but I'll tell you, just like the Republicans can get themselves kicked the heck out of the House next year, if Macron does not put something on the table, if he doesn't get something going in the job, one in every five young French people, population, cannot get a job. They're absolutely structurally unemployed. And if he can't solve that and get that economy moving, he'll be kicked out and she'll be
very similar to what's happened here. You know, you've got those who are the young,
under Obama,
the young, you know, those who were Bernie supporters feeling very disenfranchised. Yeah. And, you know, it's a very interesting.
Jacob Meister, Chris Roebling, Touche tonight in the download, Touché. Guys. Jacob, thanks for filling in tonight.
Absolutely.
Chris, see you next week.
Good to have you.
It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, last night's 18-inning loss, so Cub. I mean, it was filled with improbable comebacks, thrilling plays in the outfield, near misses, even a chance to win the game at the end. Even after the game, Anthony Rizzo said it was just fun to play in a game like that. I guess that's what being so Cub means today, right? Even with the sweep, the Cubs started the 2017 campaign with a strong April. Look to be back to their winning ways just a mere 6 months after the World Series victory, the first in 108 years. Hard to believe. And as the Cubs look to do it again, many Cubs fans wonder if the years of futility and heartbreak are a thing of the past. Memories for sure, but not a way of life. After all, I didn't see any wait till next year signs at Wrigley during the home opener. As we noted throughout the playoff run, there's something special to be a Cubs fan. Several generations remarking on how the magical run didn't just make them happy as sports fans, but it made them feel something more, sort of like family. One diehard fan has penned a new book called My Cubs, A Love Story, and that man is Scott Simon. He's the host of NPR's Weekend Edition, where as a journalist, he's won several awards, including a Peabody. He's also a special correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning. He's authored 8 books, and of course, even though he lives in Washington, D.C. now, he's a lifelong Chicagoan. Scott Simon, my guest tonight at the big table. Thanks for being here.
Oh, delighted to be here, Justin. And that's a wonderful song. That you played. Yeah,
that's it,
I think,
right?
That's, I love that.
Remix.
That's my favorite song. Yeah, absolutely. I think the Lyric Opera should do that.
Yeah, there you go. There you
did
go.
They? I wonder. I know the cast of Hamilton did, but
I feel like everybody did something special.
Yeah, exactly.
Their version of a C on the building or something like that. Why call this a love letter?
You know, I wanted to call it The Greatest Story Ever Told, but my publisher said it was coming out too close to the Easter season and there'd be competition for that. You know, it is. I mean, it's with now that my parents are gone, it is the longest lasting love of my life. I can't remember a time I didn't love the Cubs. You know, and it is a love story, damn it, because you go through periods. You know, there are times when it's intense. There are times when you get very frustrated. There are times when you get very put out. There are times when you even want to walk away and say, I've had it. I can't take it anymore. And then, you know, a couple of minutes later, you're, honey, I'm sorry. I didn't mean that. And so, yes, it is a love story.
Yeah, I mean, and it is a love. You say this with, you know, the idea that this being the longest love in your life now. I mean, this goes back, I mean, to childhood. I mean,
yeah,
for you,
absolutely.
And a lot of this book, the first half of it really is about that experience. The experience of not just growing up in the shadow of the ballpark and riding the L and going to school nearby, but really about how the Cubs were family.
It gets, you know, it gets in your blood, and there's a relationship between the Cubs and the North Side of Chicago, that club, that's really not duplicated in any other sport or in any other city. Maybe a little bit in Boston, except the area around Fenway Park has always been a little different. I think certainly with the old Brooklyn Dodgers and Brooklyn. But that's it. The Cubs are definitely unique as far as that goes. And, you know, look, in our grammar school, which is on Pine Grove and Grace, Senn High School, 5900 North Pine, the north side of Chicago, when the windows were open in April or the fall, when the weather was warm, you could hear an occasional cheer from Wrigley Field on those off days when the Cubs would actually hit a home run. And then when we would take the L home, from Senn, get on at Thorndale, and by the time we got to the Addison Street Station, school out at 3:15, we had, you know, after-school activities, typically either the W or L flag, usually the L flag in those days, would be flapping out of the stadium, and people would be getting on to go home on the platform. So it just weaves its way into your everyday
experience.
And it's
amazing to think about, even telling that story, because a lot of Chicagoans listening probably can relate to that story.
Yeah.
They know it. But it really is. It's a unique story when it comes to sports, not just Chicago sports, but
sports in
general. It
doesn't happen in any other city. And look, I have been, I've been to a lot of baseball stadiums at this particular point, and some of the new ones are great. I think of the one in Pittsburgh, the one in San Francisco. But, you know, they're trying to imitate Wrigley Field. I mean, in San Francisco, they even have the red brick and some, you know, some sprouts of ivy. They're trying to imitate Wrigley Field. The one thing they don't have is a neighborhood surrounding it. I mean, the ballpark in San Francisco is beautiful,
yeah, right.
But it's on the wharves. I mean, it's the Seals neighborhood. And look, they're great neighbors, and I there's a seal who lives down the hall from us, and we think he's, if it is a he, I'm not sure. I never looked. It's great. But the point of it is the club has a relationship with the north side of Chicago that's utterly distinct in this country.
And I would say that because of that, of course, and we've talked about it a zillion times here in Chicago, just the idea that it's a baseball park in the middle of a neighborhood, it's not just the north side, it's the people.
Yeah.
That live in the north side. It's the connection to the people and creating some sort, as you mentioned, some sort of love affair that lasts. It doesn't really matter. I mean, at a certain point, it doesn't matter if they win or lose. The feeling is there. The romanticism is there.
I mean, they're like, one of the things that I read about in the book is the extraordinary number of people who have managed to conspire to get their cremated ashes scattered somewhere in Wrigley Field, which the club hates. You're not supposed to do it. And, I understand that. I mean, if every Cub fan, myself included, could have their cremated ashes strewn in Wrigley Field, the players would be knee-deep in human remain ashes. And that's... For one thing, it'll slow down the grounder, right?
Right.
You don't want that. At least most years, you don't want that. And the club has made some very secret, kind of confidential exceptions over the years. They don't want it done. But so many of us fans have managed to sneak at least a few ashes of our loved ones in there. I mean, you talk to funeral directors on the north side, they'll say people are always going, thanks very much, and I'm good. And they'll say, don't tell us. You're not supposed to do it. But that's how much it means to people. And I have, by the way, I've already told my family, I've given them the seat numbers. So the whole idea is that, they bring me in a little plastic bottle at some point.
You've got it all figured out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Scott Simon's my guest, the longtime host of NPR's Weekend Edition, also the special correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning. He's written a new book called My Cubs, A Love Story. We'll take a quick break. We come back. And I kind of buried the lead a little bit because I continue to say it's like family, but for in your case, realistically,
a couple of family members.
You have family members that are famed Chicago Cubs in the lore.
The one whose statue is
we'll talk about that coming up here on the Download at the Big Table. My guest Scott Simon, stay with us. Celebrate your love for literature with Al Franken, Amy Dickinson, Heather Ann Thompson, Scott Simon. Right, you're going to be at the Printers Row Lit Fest.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I am. What a distinguished group. I don't think I can live up to it.
Visit printersrowlitfest.org.
You know who's interviewing me at the Literary?
Who?
Irvine Welsh, who wrote
Trainspotting. Right? He's been on the show.
Has he been on the show? Yeah, a lot of people don't know that. One of the great British novelists lives in Chicago. Why should that surprise
us? And there'll be some articles that'll come out on him where they're like, wow, the guy who wrote Trainspotting is just riding the L.
Yeah.
Like he's just riding the Southport L, but that kind of thing. So, it's great to have.
A lot of people don't know this, but Jean-Paul Sartre actually lived in Chicago.
I did not know that.
Yeah, no. Miguel Cervantes, when he wrote Don Quixote, he's actually living in Chicago.
Did you know what? I didn't pick it up in the
I didn't. Scott Simon. Trying to add some knowledge to this, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for the history lesson. Yeah. My guest tonight, Scott Simon, he's the author of My Cubs, A Love Story, of course. Scott, the longtime host of NPR's Weekend Edition, as well as a special correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning. All right, so as we continue our conversation about being a lifelong Cub fan, and I do want to ask about, the idea of being a Cub fan from far away. I mean, being in D.C., a lot of your adult life, just sort of still being a Cub fan and how that plays out. We'll get to that. But what I mentioned right before the break was the idea that I've alluded to this idea of Cubs, there's family, it's family. But in your case, it really is family. I mean, let's talk about some of the connections.
That way. My godfather... I called him Uncle Jack. He was very close to us. Was Jack Brickhouse, the longtime Chicago Cubs announcer, who's a statue of him and not a very flattering one. I don't mind saying,
tourists love it.
Yeah, exactly.
I see him
all
the time.
All right, the people who don't remember him, maybe some. No. I love it. But in any event, he, my godfather, and of course, if I may, because I don't get a chance to do this on NPR. That's it. Back. Hey. All the way out on Waveland Avenue. And I don't mind adding here, years ago I was told by a woman in New York that men of a certain vintage from the north side of Chicago, she could tell that they were from Chicago if in their moment of highest romantic fruition, if you catch my drift.
Yes, I got it.
And I don't mean drift, would shout, hey! And I told this to Uncle Jack. number of years ago, and he thought it was the greatest ratification of his life's work ever. So he used to lean over to me whenever we said goodbye, hug and kiss, and he'd go, "You keep saying hey, hey now, kid. You keep saying hey, hey." So he was my godfather. And, you know, when my father and I went to the park, it was to see Uncle Jack. And so, it was very... He would take me to the locker room, but you know, it was very, very common for us to just sit up with him in the booth as he did the game with Jack Rosenberg, his longtime producer. And after my father died, I was 16. Uncle Jack really tried. My father, as a lot of people know, didn't. He had a decline because of his drinking for many years. Uncle Jack was a good friend to him, good friend to our family, and he really tried to step in and be a kind of father figure to me. So it was very common for me during baseball season to get off the when I was coming home from Senn High School, I would get off the train at Addison, and if the game was out, Uncle Jack was not gone from the ballpark. He was at a place called the Pink Poodle,
right.
And I would join him there, and he would be there with people from the club and Jack Rosenberg, people from the WGN crew, and he was a great father figure.
Do you think that plays? I mean, loss of your father at the age of 16, the way that Jack Brickhouse kind of took you in.
Absolutely.
Does that play into the,
sure,
to the love affair?
It absolutely, solidified my relationship and the feeling that the Cubs were personal. The Cubs were part of, and not just part of family, but personal.
Right.
And look, I also don't mind saying, when you lose your father, and we are sitting. I shouldn't keep talking about the studio where we are, but we're more or less across the street and above a place called the Billy Goat Tavern. My father lived in what was then a rundown hotel. It's now the Inn of Chicago, and I'm sure it's not rundown. But on the other hand, it was called the St. Clair Hotel. It was a spot where a lot of show business people, often down on their luck, lived. And my father and I were there. And we would come over to the Billy Goat Tavern, which was then, this was before Second City made it some kind of national tourist something like that. Then it was the Billy Goat. And Sam Sionis was there, and Billy Goat was often there. Sam was his nephew who ran the place. And we would watch Cubs games there, typically when they were out of town, because then it would be at night. And then, of course, sometimes during the day, I would come home from school and we would watch the Cubs game.
And that's what I mean. There's this sort of feeling that people can relate to the story. And they can relate on the idea of being in an elementary school and be able to hear the park or taking the L pass. But, your story goes much deeper than that.
Well, and also, my Auntie Marion was married to a man named Charlie Grimm, who was the Cubs manager the last time they were in the World Series before 2016. In 1945, he was also the longtime first baseman and a great left-handed banjo player. My Auntie Marion was a lounge singer, and that's actually how they met. She knew who he was, but he was mostly a left-handed banjo. In those days, Justin, a baseball player did not earn $7 million a year.
Right.
I don't know how much Uncle Charlie ever earned. The club kept him on as a goodwill ambassador, and he did just fine. But he played the banjo and entertained because people would pay money to hear him. That's what he did to keep going.
That was a side job.
Yeah, no,
exactly. Manager of the Chicago Cubs, the World Series Chicago Cubs, and he's also playing banjo on the side.
Yeah, of course. Not always on the side. Sometimes that's principally what he did for a number of years. So in any event, they married, and he was, of course, very important to the club. And Uncle Charlie was absolutely just a great guy. He will be forever enshrined in the memory of a lot of people because he is at the very center of Norman Rockwell's famous picture, The Dugout, which appeared on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post. I have the date in the book, 1948. And where he's got it, he hated that picture because he thought Rockwell made him look like a basset hound. And he's got his, huge right hand. Uncle Charlie, he had enormous hands. As he used to say, they're not good for carrying a briefcase, just a mitt, and I will add an old-fashioned glass. And he had one of his big hands against the side of his chin, and he looks enormously embarrassed. Everybody in that picture, some kind of Cub imbecility has just happened on this field.
That photo plays very deep into the psyche of the lovable losers. It sets this sort of national storyline.
I think that's part of what began to set the national storyline. When you're on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post, which was the largest circulation in the days they had large circulation magazines, that was the largest, and it was a household fixture. So it made the Cubs the very national image of not just losers, but I will say lovable losers. There was something absolutely lovable about it. The Bat Boy in there it looks to be the most embarrassed. You know, his heroes have somehow, you know, committed some kind of imbecility that's beyond. And the genius of the picture is you don't understand what's happened. You don't need to. You just know that was so Cubs-like. The Cubs
so,
will do.
So Cub.
You know, these were the years where, you know, at one point there was a triple play on third base, if I'm not mistaken, of, you know, all Cubs getting tagged out, 1, 2, 3. All these kind. You know, it was years after Babe Ruth had pointed to center field or allegedly pointed to center field, although in the book, I quote,
you do, yeah.
Retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, who was a young, I think,
there,
a 10-year-old
right?
at the game, and he's convinced Ruth pointed to center field.
There's other people say that didn't happen. But
other
yeah,
people
but,
say
but,
it didn't happen.
Yeah, but I trust.
Justice Stevens, come on. Now.
Justice Stevens
is pretty good. And, you know, that just seemed to be so Cubs-like, because here he was, the most feared home run hitter in baseball. And whatever reaction that he registered, whether he was pointing to center or not, the fact is the Cubs bench was razzing him. What kind of idiots razz the greatest home run hitter? You know, when he comes up, you should say, good to see you, Mr. Ruth. Lots of luck, Mr. Ruth. We appreciate your sportsmanship, Mr. Ruth. Instead, you know, I can only imagine what kind of imprecations they were shouting at him. He gets angry. He hits a home run. That is so Cubs-like.
So Cubs-like. Yeah. Scott Simon, the author of My Cubs, A Love Story. He's in studio tonight. We're talking about the Cubs, baseball, Chicago, family. Scott Simon, of course, the host of NPR's Weekend Edition, a special correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning. Let's take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll continue the conversation with Scott here on The Download at the Big Table. Stay with us.
And when the Cubs go marching in, and when the Cubs go marching in, I want to be in the bleachers when the Cubs go marching.
Indeed. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman, my guest tonight at the big table. Scott Simon, his book, My Cubs, A Love Story. Scott Simon, of course, the host of NPR's Weekend Edition. Also the special correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning. Author of 8 books, won a Peabody.
And adult films.
Yeah, several adult films.
Although people wouldn't recognize my voice so much from adult films if I grunted a bit or something.
You know, if I did the whole resume.
Yeah,
I can't go right.
We're only on for an hour. I understand. Thank you. Yes.
Well, you know, I asked a question. I start the second half kind of in this way of like, why this sport? Why this team? I mean, Chicago has a lot of love for its sports teams. We saw with Michael Jordan, and we saw the Bears, 85. What is it about?
And also, I mean, I think the great tribute, I mean, the way the city embraced the Blackhawks.
Yeah.
You know? I mean,
right. So what is it about? What do you think it is about the Cubs that connects you to that sort of? I mean, you talked about your family and you talk about the connection.
Part of it, you know, baseball is a daily sport for 3/4 of the year. It's something that is in. It's in our lives almost each and every day from spring until fall. So that's got a lot to do with it. It's also a long game, isn't it? I mean, it takes up a lot of our time if we follow. Oh, well, now they're not always 18 innings. By the way, I was heartsick when, you know, they lost at the last second like that. I think the fact is, if you split the game into 2 9-inning games, they won the second.
Yeah, right.
Because they scored more runs. I think there's time for creative scoring. But in any event.
That's right.
I think that's part of why baseball winds its way into our lives the way it does. And I think particularly in this city, and I got to be careful when I'm on tour with the book outside of Chicago, but I will, you know, I will say this here. For some cities in this country, look, I'm very excited about the Cleveland Cavaliers. I think they're great. I think what LeBron James, his feeling for Cleveland is great. I know how them winning a world championship lifted up that city.
Right, right.
And now that Steve Kerr is not at the moment the head coach of the Warriors, our old Chicago and, you know, Steve Kerr, maybe I can without any kind of recriminations, I can root for the Cavaliers. But you know what? Chicago never needed a World Series championship to have a positive self-image, to think, oh, things are improving, things are looking up, isn't this a great city after all?
Right.
Chicagoans have always known that.
And yet the Cubs are as Chicago, you can't separate them.
No,
meaning it's not like,
not.
You know,
yeah.
You could put the Cubs, it could be in Washington or you know, so in Atlanta. They can't be. They have to be in Chicago, yet they don't define necessarily the positive outlook of Chicagoans to their own city.
I developed the idea that it was a way of acknowledging our frailty. you know, a city that could otherwise be just a little bit hard to take with our, you know, our pompousness and self-assurance and our, you know, our Chicago kind of New Yorker view of the world that, you know, everything. I've my wife, who is French, as you know, Justin, said she learned a long time ago that everything in Western civilization can be traced back to Chicago. She never knew it growing up in France. And by the way, we're sitting here and I keep pointing out these landmarks. Forgive me. We are just up the street at the corner of the Michigan Avenue Bridge is where I proposed to my wife, because there is a plaque there that commemorates the spot where Père Marquette, Father Marquette, first ran into the soil we now call Chicago. So to me, that was the French-Chicago connection.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, thank you.
That's thought out, that, right.
Yeah.
I thought maybe you're just shopping the Mag Mile, and you're like, well, this might be a good spot.
No. I thought it out. I had the whole thing.
That's part of what I love about the book, too, because you get specific into talking about, you know, the memories and experiences. You even go all the way up to your memories of what happened during the World Series last fall.
Oh, my gosh,
There's something great about the idea of the romanticism of being a Cubs fan, and because you're a Chicagoan.
Yeah.
And you just pointed out right there, just the idea that you would want to share your life with this woman, and she's French, and there's a connection, and you went to the bridge, and you know, there's something about the way that as Chicagoans we can be harsh and hard on the outside, but there's something about our connection, our love for the things that we do love. And in this case, a lot of times it's the Cubs.
Yeah. And that, you know, that touched my wife about Chicago immediately. She'd never been to Chicago until that day that we got engaged. I think she changed planes here or something. The friendliness of the city and the passionate belief that people in Chicago, the love that we have, you know, and particularly because it was in May, oh my gosh, I can't believe it, 17 years ago. I'd have to go back and check the exact date. It was around this time of year, certainly, because I remember we were taking the cab because there was some book convention in town, and we were taking the cab and a Cubs game was on. The cab driver had it on, and the Cubs were ahead 2-1. And so she knew that I was going to pop the question. So we're in the cab, and I'm listening to the game, and I turn to her, and I said, hey, the Cubs are ahead. And she goes, bloody hell, I cannot believe it. You are actually paying attention to the game.
Even in that moment.
She couldn't get the Cubs out. And we had, you know, we had our celebratory drink at right downstairs.
You can tell by the stories that you tell that you love the city yes. that you're from. You currently reside though in Washington D.C. and you do, that's where you do Weekend Edition. Mm-hmm. Talk about the Cubs from a different looking in. Talking about Chicago looking in. As a Chicagoan and celebrating and romanticizing your love for this team, especially when they're on the rise to the championship, how is that perceived outside of Chicago? Do they recognize that connection?
Oh, gosh, yes, absolutely. And I think part of what made the Cubs a national enthusiasm this year, and it's been building, of course, their games have been on all across the country, all across the world, really, for a number of years. And, you know, right. WGN Superstation. Whatever happens now, going forward, as they say in the broadcasting business, it, you know, made it a household staple. In the middle of the day, we must say, because of the overwhelming dominance of day games. And look, I say in the book, so many places in the country, even the world, I've gone into, forgive me, a bar in the middle of the day to get directions or to use the phone or before the cell phones, you were ubiquitous, that sort of thing, and the Cubs game would be on, and there would be people in there that are watching it. Laying bets on it, as a matter of fact, as inveterate
sure.
people will. And I think that's part of what people, it was because the Cubs were considered to be a part of the family, even sometimes the errant child in many ways. How can you like that? It became part of the things that people treasured about the image of Chicago.
And there's something to be said about the fact that it was on TV, it was in different markets, and you got to see Wrigley Field, and you got to see this team.
And they were the anti-Yankees. Right. They were the anti-Yankees at a time, particularly in baseball, when people were resenting the big parks, the corporate giants who owned the game. Of course, the Cubs have earned multimillion-dollar salaries. You can't be competitive otherwise. But there was a lot of feeling that the Cubs were the anti-Yankees. They didn't sign the young phenoms. They couldn't, and although they tried, you know, they didn't get the next big stars. Right. They were somehow a different franchise that showed you what the national game should be. A neighborhood ballpark, you know, red brick like so many of the buildings on the north side. Red brick covered in ivy like so many of the hedges that you walk past.
Scott, it makes me think I mean, there's a connection to just Chicago. In the sense that we're different, we see ourselves as different.
Well, and I think people around the country and around the world recognize that. I think it's part of the feeling that Chicago generates outside of the city around the world. You know, there's a lot of look. You can make jokes about Chicago. You can finish a punchline with Chicago. You know, when my mother died, there was a lot of attention, as some people know, because of the tweets, and yeah. I wound up doing a book. But I remember. And I knew what everybody was laughing at. I said, well, I remember going through my mother's effects and finding her voter registration card. And I said, I found my mother's Chicago voter registration card. I'm looking forward to using it for many years to come. I mean, people laughed at that. You know, right. The Chicago makes the country laugh. Chicago has a special hold on the imagination of this country.
There's definitely a dichotomy between the sort of romanticizing and the generation that really holds the Cubs to be almost, like I said, a love affair.
Yeah.
And then there's a new generation. I don't mean
like my daughters. Yeah,
but I mean even a little bit older, a generation that you've seen that maybe in the baseball they like the Cubs, maybe they like the Cubs for a certain reason. They like Wrigley Field. There's a lot of beer.
Yeah,
there's Wrigleyville. There's a million bars, more than there ever was in your time. I mean, just sort of talk about the contrast between your generation and really this amazing. I guess this sort of classical kind of vibe of what Chicago is versus what it is now when you stand in line to try and get a Coors Light at a bar on Clark Street.
Lots of luck. As Mark Grace, God bless him, once said in a moment of some exasperation, this has become a theme park of the national sport, baseball. In their friendly confines on the north side.
Is that hard to believe as a kid from Sen?
Sure, absolutely, because they were ours. They were the neighborhood ballpark. So to see it as a kind of a stop, almost like Disneyland, as it is, of course, for baseball
tourists
fans.
Tourists come here, right.
And not
right,
just baseball right, fans. Right. I mean, people come to Chicago, they want to see Wrigley Field. That's one of the things I think the Ricketts family is trying to do now, in that if you come to Chicago now in December, they want to give you a reason to see Wrigley Field. And I understand that. I mean, I actually do go to Wrigley Field in December, although it's usually to get, you know, Cubs gifts at I shouldn't mention the name of a store here unless they're actually buying ad space on
I think that's
the
all
download, right? Yeah, not allowed. Okay, I'll be careful about that. But in any event, I think it has become a theme park of baseball, and not just baseball, of what sports fans are supposed to be, that kind of love and loyalty and feeling that you have for it.
Scott, do you think that will history be rewritten now that the Chicago Cubs are World Series champions? Will the stories that you've told and the romanticizing of the lovable losers and the idea of the Saturday Evening Post photo and will that sort of, you know, as we think about human history, will that sort of dissolve?
I don't think so. Not entirely, because it's still our history. I think it's you know, it's history that we venerate and that we remember and is important to us. So I understand that the Ricketts family is trying to turn it into a quality franchise.
How dare they?
How dare they do that? You know, to be... I almost said like the Yankees, better than the Yankees, I think, particularly better than the Yankees have been in recent years, although as good as the Yankees have been in the last 3 days, let's put it that way. They obviously had a good series here at Wrigley. But I understand they're trying to turn it into a quality franchise, but that history is something that will stick. And more importantly, the relationship between the neighborhood, the North Side, and the team, that's going to stay. Become even closer and more fierce. You know, I think, and I say this in the book, the hardest thing to do in professional sport is to repeat a championship.
Right.
Not just to win it the first time.
Teams are coming in and they want to play the champs.
Because they consider somehow their year is made if they're able to. Look, the Yankees are already talking about World Series because they swept the Cubs in three games.
That's right, in early May.
Yeah.
You know, as we wrap up, you wrote a love letter to the Cubs, but how much of this is a love letter to Jack Brickhouse, to Charlie Grimm, to your parents, to your dad, to your mom.
Sure,
I mean, just the people who weren't here to see it that experienced the Cubs the way you did.
Oh, I think absolutely a lot of it. I don't know, 75, 85%. My wife was saying just as I was leaving home today, she said, unfortunately, she lost her mother just recently. We lost my mother-in-law. And she was talking about what a shame. My wife is the French member of the family, but for reasons that are beyond us, our children used to refer to my mother as grand-mère. I don't know how the Irish woman got the French title of grandmother, but there you go. And my wife was saying, you know, what a shame that grand-mère isn't around to see this. And by that, she meant the World Series victory, but she just meant the enthusiasm for the Cubs, yeah. That marvelous welcome home parade, the reception at the White House, that wonderful ceremony with a president from Chicago and the team from the north side of Chicago. And yes, if there's a wistfulness to me about it, it's because Uncle Jack and Uncle Charlie and my mother, and for that matter, my mother-in-law, because one of the few things she really knew about the United States was her son-in-law and the Chicago Cubs. Well, I shouldn't say that. I was about to say she also liked Colin Farrell, but he's British. So, okay, the Cubs and her son-in-law, that was it.
And a lot of people don't know Colin Farrell, a Chicagoan.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Nice. He was in Second City.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that about Colin Farrell.
The book
is
called My Cubs, A Love Story. The author, Scott Simon, the host of NPR's Weekend Edition, also a special correspondent at CBS Sunday Morning. The great book. Thank you so much for coming. And you'll be back
My
at
pleasure.
The Lit Fest here coming up in
I will, in June, right?
In June, right?
Yes, in June. I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
Scott, thanks for being my guest. Appreciate
it. Oh, my pleasure. Wonderful.
Awesome to have Scott Simon in the studio, wearing the Cubs scarf. He'll be at Lit Fest coming up here in a month. All right, coming up, we have a great second half of the show. Lily Kay is going to be in Studio 435 tonight, the great R&B jazz singer, Magic, her album that's out. We had her on, let's see, right around Thanksgiving time, I feel like she was on. She was just a guest. She didn't perform, and we got her to come in. She's bringing the band, do the whole thing tonight. She'll be at Studio 435. Tremendous performer. Can't wait to talk with her and also hear her perform live. Also coming up, the two women, Columbia College students and Chicago improvisers behind the web series Chapstick. It's looking for season two. They put out a FundMe page, an Indiegogo page. They got it. Like that. They had a successful run in season one of Chapstick. It's about following two women in Chicago, sort of living life, managing life as two gay women in Chicago. But it's really the concept of why they did the series, and I'm looking forward to talking to them about it, is that they felt like the LGBT entertainment, the stuff that's on television right now, even some of the movies, is lacking. They feel like everything is about how serious it is to be gay. And they are... You know, it's a big part of the web series, but it's not the punch. It's not the main focus, the main punch of the web series. So just, I mean, it's this idea of like you can have gay characters without just being all gay. That's what they're going for. So we'll talk with two women coming in. They're coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, and then Rob Elder's here. Very excited to talk with him, the man who authored Hidden Hemingway. They've unearthed a new love letter. We talked about this at the beginning of the show. A new love letter. Ernest Hemingway. It's like it's like if they found a new Tupac song right now. You'd be like, what? A new Tupac? What? But in 50 years from now. That's how hot this is. So this is coming up. We'll talk with Robert coming up here in the 9 o'clock hour. So a lot to do tonight. I'm excited. That was good. Scott Simon was good. It's fun to have him on. He's a tremendous, tremendous broadcaster, and you can see him on CBS Sunday Morning, other places. But, yeah, you read the stories, and it is funny because you read the stories, and they're so relatable in the book. I mean, I feel like it's my dad telling me about, you know, flipping seats at Wrigley Field or, you know, jumping the fence in the fifth inning to try and get in there after, you know, when school got out. Same types of stories, except Scott's hanging out with Jack Brickhouse afterwards in the broadcaster's bar, which I didn't know existed. There was a broadcaster's bar. Essentially, they'd be done, and they're like, let's go to our bar. And they'd all go hang out, and Scott Simon was allowed in. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll start the second half of the download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, coming up to 10 o'clock hour, Studio 435. Lily Kay. Yes, looking forward to having her here. Should be fun. Last year, we had Robert Elder in studio to talk about his book, Hidden Hemingway, a book that explored the Ernest Hemingway archives in Oak Park. Hemingway grew up there. A lot to learn about his upbringing in this area. But this just in, a new revelation. That's right. Robert Elder just published a piece in the Paris Review, unearthing a new series of letters that Hemingway sent to an unrequited love back home when he was volunteering for the Red Cross in World War I. What? New works by one of the most mysterious yet explored authors of our time, it looks like. And it could rewrite what we know of Ernest Hemingway's early days. Robert Elder back in studio with us. Thanks for being here. You're a literary sleuth.
A little bit, yeah. The Hemingway detective. I've sort of like fallen backward into it.
This story, I mean, I feel like we are in the presence of what might be a new cable series, the sort of tracking down the world of Ernest Hemingway. But this really comes out of your detective work to realize that there was more that was out there you just didn't know about.
Well, right. Well, I mean, I had done sort of parallel to the book, I'd done a piece for the Chicago Tribune about this poem to a woman named Annette DeVoe, who is this woman he held a torch for. And as I dug more, I kept seeing Annette DeVoe next to the name Francis Coates in his letters. And he always talked about, you know, I had good taste in women, Annette DeVoe and Francis Coates. So I just tracked down Francis Coates' family. And I got a hold of her granddaughter, a woman named Betsy Fermano out in Boston. And I said, hey, did your grandmother ever date Ernest Hemingway? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And the thing
yeah.
is, like,
who's
that,
this?
Yeah. That fundamentally changes the biography because even his classmates said, no, he never dated in high school. Girls were not interested in him. He was not interested in girls.
Oh,
so that's a fundamental change.
Okay.
And then she says, yeah, in fact, I have a couple letters here, at which time my like heart skips because, I mean, they're from 1918, and letters from that era don't exist sort of outside the family. So it's him flirtatious with this girl who, you know, I say in the Paris Review that, you know, he was squarely in the friend zone. But, you know, they went to operas together. They went to dinner together. But he just could not get out of that.
Yeah, so they're not area. So they're not sort of sonnets. They're not love letters. He's not like, well, I love you more than I love
he's
cake.
Trying to make her jealous,
right.
though. Like, he's saying things like, you know, now I can write love letters in Italian. And, you know, I can't say in English my treasure, but mia tesora, you know, just flows out of the pen. And the implication is, would you like me to write you love letters? And she's not biting. And he's trying to make her jealous by saying, you know, there's all these beautiful women here. And he's talking about, you know, how he's tested all the beer, which, again, is a rebellious thing because Oak Park is a dry town.
So he's sort of showing off.
He's showing off. And
he's
again,
becoming worldly.
Yeah. And he is so sort of self-deprecating and charming. And he's talking about, you know, so he was a volunteer ambulance driver for the Red Cross in World War I. And he was in Italy. And he talks about, you know, this injury. He got a massive injury. You know, he was caught in a mortar attack. He had 227 wounds, shrapnel wounds. Mm, and the guy next to him dies. And the way he sort of talks about it in this letter is, yes, I got into an argument with a mortar shell, and the mortar shell won. So he's being sort of self-deprecating. And he's trying to make her jealous. And it's sort of an intimacy and a boyishness you don't see anywhere else. So
really?
Yeah.
It truly is. I mean, when you talk about it sort of unearthing, I mean, unearthing might be the right way. Because not unlike an archaeologist, you're piecing together the world. And to find this letter, it sort of sheds light on an area that we didn't know much about with Ernest Hemingway.
Well, yeah. Well, and you know, this is one of the reasons I love my wife. She texted me just before and she said, did Justin just compare you to Tupac?
Yeah,
and it is sort of like a lost track because it's a different voice. Sandy Spanier, who's the she's the general editor for the Hemingway's Letter Project. I said, okay, keep this under your hat, but tell me what I have. And she said, you know, it's a fascinating find, and it's extremely rare. It's a really fresh view of him. And she says, you know, it'll be of great interest to any future biographer.
How do you, as a as an investigator and as someone who, you know, has put together works, how do you authenticate that? I mean, do you automatically, when you start reading the letter, go, oh, my God, this is Hemingway?
Yeah.
How do you,
yeah.
I mean, is that pretty much?
Well, not only that, so you have You have you know where it came from, and it's also on Red Cross stationery, which he also wrote on to other people.
Yeah, right.
It's the right period. It's the right set of relationships. And also, it's his handwriting, because I don't know if you've ever seen his handwriting, but it always slants almost off the paper. So it hit all the hallmarks. And then also, you know, it's not actually just these two letters. The woman who he was writing to, again, her name was Frances Coates. Her family called her, and her friends called her Effie, F-E. She wrote this 10-page remembrance of what it was like to grow up with him. Like, that is super rare, to have an intimate sort of portrait of him
and
his family.
So she was aware of his fame. As he got older, she wrote about him.
No.
Or collected.
Well, she always kept track of him.
Yeah, kept track. That's right. Yeah.
But, you know, she was a locally famous opera swinger. She was a danseuse, which meant she would perform sort of mini operas. She would tell the story of an opera. She helped found the Three Arts Club locally.
Oh, okay.
She
lived
in Hinsdale for a while. She lived in Oak Park. So she was a social fixture. She went to Northwestern University. But when Carlos Baker, Hemingway's first biographer, reached out to her, she sort of was uncomfortable talking about him. I think she didn't want to sort of add to the cult of Hemingway. And the other thing was, you know, during that time in her life, it was painful to remember because her mother had a long illness, and she died very young. So it was not an easy thing for her to remember. So again, she wrote Baker this letter that she never sent, that's 10 pages long. And it's a lot of detail about what his mother was like, you know, this majestic woman who moved like with great authority, like a battleship. And also, you know, she talks about Hemingway in ways that are not, you know, particularly flattering. You know, she talks about his the thing she recognized him in as a boy. She recognizes this jealousy that never went away. And in fact, I'll quote it, quote, "The inferior complex remained to the end. The inferiority complex remained to the end. And with it came the braggadocio and the need to become somebody to himself, a quick and deadly jealousy of his own prestige and a constant and consuming need for applause."
Wow.
She's a great writer, isn't she? So it's, again, you get his view of the world, and you know, he's writing it because the two letters we found, he's writing it to her when he's wounded. In fact, he talks about, you know, writing on a dinner tray by candlelight that's stuck in a bayonet,
right,
you know,
yeah.
Which probably not true, but it's still a nice image.
Yeah, but he writes it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something, you know, there's something of a cottage industry to find out more about Ernest Hemingway and his life. I mean, there's, you mentioned it, the Hemingway letters, you know, there's boards, there's other things. I mean, how influential or how important is this unearthing? I mean, are we talking about rewriting what we know about Ernest Hemingway's history?
I think that remains to be seen, but in the just scratching the surface, her name shows up all over his work. So Francis, and Francis with an E, not with an I. You know, he has a famous short story called The Short Happy Life of Francis Macomber. Also, whether he meant to or not, there's a bit from his novel To Have and Have Not where Effie sees herself. In fact, she is sort of commenting on this in this letter, and it's a piece where she recognizes her and her husband being caricatured. And I'll read a little bit of it. So this is Hemingway from To Have and Have Not. "The fiancé is a skull and bones man, voted most likely to succeed, voted most popular, who still thinks more of others than of himself and would be too good for anyone except a lovely girl like Frances. He's probably a little too good for Frances too, but it will be years before Frances realizes this, perhaps. And she may never realize it with luck. The type of man who is tapped for the bones is rarely also tapped for bed. But with a lovely girl like Frances, intention counts as much as performance." So it's all over. And he actually uses, in a really early short story,
wow,
up in Michigan, he uses her her middle name and last name, Liz Coates, in this really sexually charged short story. In fact, it was almost not published because it was sort of too graphic. So
this is like Illuminati stuff, yeah, you're dealing with here. You're unearthing some stuff.
But she pops up everywhere. And so I think a next generation of scholarship can probably uncover a little bit more. But I was just amazed how much she permeates.
I mean, you explored the, you did a lot of exploration. You've done a lot of investigation for Hidden Hemingway. Where does this rank in terms of finds? I mean, for you, I mean, because a lot of this stuff you knew about and you kind of, you pieced it together for the book, but this is something that you personally went and sought out.
Well, and I didn't know it existed. I didn't. So I didn't know it was there to find. I just stumbled into it. And actually, I stumbled into it, and it was the best possible scenario. Something that nobody else knew, that revealed that something that no one had ever even thought of.
Yeah.
So it's been amazing. We've gotten a lot of like really amazing, unexpected coverage. And I'm sort of inundated with phone calls and emails now saying, like, okay, what's the status of this? Where is it? Can you give me her email address? It's been amazing.
Yeah, and it also, I mean, from the letter that she didn't send,
mm-hmm.
and even the work of Hemingway's letters to her, I mean, how, in your estimation, as someone who's really piecing together the biography of Ernest Hemingway, how much has it changed your perception of the man?
It helps me see him as someone who's softer, because for so much of his life, he was a scoundrel, a very colorful scoundrel. But in general, he betrayed everybody who ever helped him. You know, there was a reason he was married four times. He was a difficult personality. And I forgot who told me this, but I always remember it is we see people more clearly when we see them as children. And seeing him as a 19-year-old young man helps me sort of carve out his psychology. And it's nice to see him in this light, especially because we know what comes after.
Well, I mean, that's the issue with his story. For those not familiar, I mean, he's an enigmatic character, but he's all, like you said, a sort of a charming scoundrel. But, I mean, he commits suicide in 1961 or so?
And after a long, you know, long bout of fighting depression and alcoholism.
I mean, a ton of demons. I mean, this. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the allure of the story. Is you're like, I mean, he wrote some amazing stuff from Old Man in the Sea to other, but it really is this sort of like this tortured character behind these works. So to get a not only a glimpse of what he was like when he was younger, but to read what Effie Francis thinks of him. And what she thinks might have, you know, like what you just said about the idea of what he's trying to impress himself or whatever, it has to shed some light on his story.
It does. Again, it is a fresh view of him. And again, this is not from me. This is from Mrs. Spanier. But it is it's sort of something I never expected. And occasionally, you know, I sort of fell into the Hemingway world. You know, I was going to do one book. And then, you know, I found this poem, and then I found a note that suggests he had an affair with his sister-in-law.
Right.
And so we find, like, these little pieces, and they just keep finding me. So, no, it's been fun. It's been illuminating. I don't know how much more I'm going to do, because I really have to move on. I got to move on to the next book.
Maybe this is Hemingway's way of saying, no, you can't move on. There's still a lot more.
It's like
more.
The mafia.
Yeah.
It's like, just when I try to get out, they pull me back in.
I don't know, man. There's some extracurricular going on here. For you to be able to find that and change it, I feel like there's some spirits involved here. You're unearthing not only this letter, but you're gonna find out. You're gonna figure out who Ernest Hemingway for the whole world. I love it. I love it. Robert Elder, writer, editor here in town. His book, Hidden Hemingway, explored the Ernest Hemingway archives in Oak Park. And he just wrote for the Paris Review this story of unearthing new letters from Ernest Hemingway when he was a 19-year-old, sending to Francis
Coates.
Yeah. And she didn't respond, or she responded, but we don't have those letters.
She did. She did.
Well, that's the next one.
Yeah. No, she responds just a little bit. And the thing that's amazing is in the letters, she talks about, that letter you wrote me in Kansas City. So there are letters that are possibly still out there for people to see.
All right. Download Nation, I think we need to scrap together some money for Rob to just go around the country. Let's just give him some money and a car and let him go find out what he can about Ernest Hemingway. Robert, thanks for coming in. Thanks for telling us this story. If you get any updates, anything else, let us know.
Thanks, man.
Wow, a mystery. I'm telling you, man. If I were a man of means, I'd be crowdsourcing that, right? I'd be throwing my millions around, being like, I'd like to see the documentary on this. Unearthed, as I threw dollar bills in the air. Unearthed. Such a good story, right? I'm not a big Ernest Hemingway. I don't know much about it. Rob's book was the first time I really dug into it, and that was last year. But the idea that there's so many scholars and so many people who want to find out more about this mysterious writer in his life, to then for someone to go, I got a couple letters. It really is, man. It's like river monsters for literature. I love it. Go get him, Rob. I hope you... Yes. All right, coming up, the creators of the web series Chapstick and a live studio performance, Studio 435 with Lily Kay. Stay with us. This download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Coming up at Studio 435, Lily Kay, the great jazz R&B singer. She's got the residency over at Alice at Soho House. And she also is doing a show where she's tributing Ella Fitzgerald coming up at the end of the month. So we'll talk to her about that, and she'll be performing live, Studio 435 in the 10 o'clock hour. The web series Chapstick. It's a comedy that follows two best friends, Addie and Marlo. And according to the description on the website, here's what they say. They deal with that follows Addie and Marlo as they deal with the daily struggle of being artists, being women, liking women, and finding their place in this vast world. It's the brainchild of two Chicago comedians, Charlotte Kennett and Kearney Fagan, two Columbia College students who improvise around town. Chapstick was made both really because Charlotte and Kearney are gay, and they believe that the majority of the LGBTQ television and media is lacking. In this series, they happen to be gay, but it isn't all about being gay. The series is getting ready for a second season. They just put out an Indiegogo fundraising page. They made their goal like that. In studio with me tonight, Charlotte Kennett, Kearney Fagan, the creators of Chapstick. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Great series. Congratulations on the success and the fact that season two is underway, right?
Yeah, we're super excited about it. We actually just filmed the first two episodes of season two this past weekend, so we're stoked.
Was I accurate in summing up why you guys took on Chapstick?
Yeah, definitely. I think that there are starting to be some great LGBTQ characters on television, but it's always sort of a big deal, and like they have a coming out story, and we didn't really want to do that. We were like, gay characters just need their own like comedy series where it's not all about like, mom and dad, I'm gay.
Yeah, right. The coming out story is super old. We are definitely trying to avoid that type of stuff. Of course, we toy on that, but it's really about making LGBTQ characters three-dimensional instead of one-dimensional. Because when we watch, you know, the average NBC show, not to just crap on NBC, we love NBC, but you oftentimes just see this character who just oozes with gayness, especially, you know, they just follow these stereotypes that are pretty old. And, you know, we are three-dimensional people who just
That's part of it, too. I mean, there is this sort of old stereotype. And the stereotypes of any sort of gay media, what ends up happening is they create a lot of drama or comedy or anything's around those stereotypes, and you see it more and more, and that seems to be something that I guess you're seeing less and less of it as it goes on, just with the sort of spreading out of so many other options for people to consume media, not just at NBC or ABC or CBS, things like that. Do you guys feel that it's getting better? Do you feel like that perhaps the landscape is changing?
I think through the internet, so much more representation is happening because people
want it. Yeah.
And they can make their own content. and like the people that are LGBTQ can make LGBTQ content and mm-hmm. so on.
Right. Yeah. You're not playing to a mass audience and right. hoping mm-hmm. that they understand everything. You're playing directly to mm-hmm. the yeah. audience you want to.
Yeah. yeah. I mean, we hope that, you know, other straight people watch the show just because, you know, again, it's supposed to just be fun and funny. And, you know, the fact that we're gay isn't at the core of it. But, you know, if someone stumbles upon it who is straight, we hope that they find, you know, as much joy in it as LGBTQ people. But, of course, LGBTQ people need a safe haven of TV shows made for them. Because if you don't see yourself on TV, you wonder if you even exist. And that sounds funny, but, you know, for me personally, no. growing up, I didn't even think that you could kiss a girl. But now I know that is so false.
You guys, how old are you? 22. I was going to say, I mean, it's like growing up. You're still growing up.
Oh, yeah.
I get in the sense that I feel like there are generations, even LGBTQ people mm-hmm. 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, there was just no representation.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. At least like growing up for me, I remember watching Buffy and having Willow and Tara, and I was like, this is great. You know, like that was the first female couple that I had ever seen, even in my life.
And for me, it was Shay Mitchell on Pretty Little Liars. I was like, wow, she is like the hottest girl ever, and she's gay. This is amazing. And that's, you know, you realize it seems so silly, but it's so fundamental to see these people in mainstream things, because then other people can become aware about their sexuality, whether that's in gender or orientation. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that, you know, if 12-year-olds are watching our show, well, hopefully they're not watching some episodes, but if they are, because YouTube is so easy to say, yes, I'm 18 when you're not, we hope that, you know, they feel like, wow, this is, I can be this, I can do this, and I can, you know, be an artist, I can be anything I want.
Well, what's great about the series, and I think to sort of boil it down, there's the concept that you're not explaining why you're gay.
No.
And I know that sounds stupid on the front, but that's a lot where I think LGBTQ stuff goes awry. When you talk about stereotypes, there's a little bit, that's the coming out story. There's a little mm-hmm. bit of why you made this choice or what about, you know, the world around you can accept or not accept.
Yeah.
This is straight. I mean, the parameters have been set in the world of ChapStick, mm-hmm. and that's it. We don't have to worry about it anymore.
Yeah, it's a quirky world.
Yeah.
we definitely don't talk about that. But yeah, we just like want everybody to accept us. And part of that is like when you're trying to accept yourself, you're like faking it a little. But the more you just keep accepting yourself, then everybody else stops questioning you, you know?
Let's talk about the production of it. Because you guys are Columbia College students. Mm. Both of you are in the Comedy Studies program at Second City. You're just about to graduate. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You also do improvisation. Talk about when, I mean, it's one thing to say, I'm going to do a web series and put this together. Talk about where this story comes from, and then let's talk about how it actually got produced.
Sure.
Well, Charlotte was doing her comedy studies semester at the Second City a semester before me, and we had this professional comedian class where we had to create a final project. And
shout out to Jen Ellison.
Yeah, she's
I know
great,
Jen. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, great teacher. And so one of the final project options was creating a pilot episode of a web series, and so Charlotte wanted
I
to
chose
create.
That, yeah.
yeah, so Charlotte wanted to do that because Charlotte's all about, you know, film and television.
So what went into that? What went into creating a pilot for a web series?
Oh, man. It was so much because you just have to know, like, exactly what... Sorry, I just saw a sign, like, fall outside. It was so distracting. But
it's okay.
This room
it's
is all right. glass. I'm like, wow. But, yeah, it was all about, for me, like, what is the story we're trying to sell? Or, like, not sell, LOL. To make. And in that came this idea of, well, Kearney and me were, like, best friends at the time. We were, you know... whatever. So I was like, Kearney's hilarious. I love Kearney. I love who we are together. This would be so funny. And why is this not on TV? Like, why can I not turn on Comedy Central and see someone like me and Kearney, you know, just having fun and like living through life and, you know, with female filmmakers, you know, being the directors, being the DPs, like, I want to see that. Like, so often it's just like men all on the credits. And it's so upsetting. Like Game of Thrones. I'm like, oh my God, you're letting me down. It's all men directing the show. I love this show, but come on, let's give women a chance too. So in this series, I was like, let's make a show that's, you know, female centric and LGBTQ centric, and we're going to do it right. We're going to have DPs be females or LGBTQ. Directors, same thing. You know, and as much as we can, we would crew this with LGBTQ people, which was a struggle, but something we still stuck to.
Was it important? I mean, how important was it? I mean, if a guy came along and is like, I'm a great DP. I'm a great gaffer. I can do great sound. Like that you said, no, this is a project that's specifically
No. Everyone was welcome as long as they were, you know, into our idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this was a project that they could get behind. I mean, we were totally all for it.
Yeah. It was just usually in the bigger roles that we really wanted to see women or LGBTQ people. And then, with this, I wrote the pilot and we filmed it, and I had a little bit of background in filmmaking. So that made it a lot easier. Like, I own some equipment and I've done other comedic sketches before. So I was really ready to finally do something, a bigger portfolio and body of work. And so I was just so excited to work with Kearney because, you know, when you meet somebody who finally kind of speaks your comedic language, it's just a relief. Like, you see Tim and Eric and Key and Peele and whoever else, you know, Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, and you're just like, wow, they get each other. And I was worried I was never going to find that person because I crack a joke. They're but Kearney gets it. So
Kearney gets it.
Yeah. We were the best team that could be for this.
Well, I mean, okay, so talk about, I mean, it's one thing to create a pilot for a student project, but it's another to put together episode upon episode for a season one and to even start a season two. I mean, this is a discipline. I mean, there's a lot of work that goes into putting together 2 to 3 to 4 minute episodes for, and you know, what you guys are doing. It's not just sort of a one shot kind of thing, and you're like, that's an episode next. I mean, there's a lot that goes into it. So talk about that process. And as you guys are making a move from a class project to something that actually is going to live outside of it on the internet.
Sure.
Well, I definitely take my hat off to Charlotte. She is a great executive producer. I know it's not her favorite thing to do, but she knows how to take charge, and she knows how a film set works. And prior to Chapstick, I really didn't. I was a stage performer for the most part. So while we, you know, wrote together and acted together, and, you know, I tried to get behind, you know, directing too, it's Charlotte took the lead on the production side of things just because she knew how it worked, and it was really impressive, and it continues to be.
Again, faking it, right? No. executive producing is so hard. I never realized how much actually went into it, but I've PA'd on some shows here in Chicago, and I think I take a lot of it from that, from being on other people's sets and seeing how it's run. So I was on, you know, Shrink, which is on CISO, and The Patriot, which is on Amazon, and The Exorcist, and just as an additional PA, you know, everybody's, you know, person that they do their craps. And
but I mean, you're talking about people Tim Baltz and Stephen Conrad.
Amazing.
I mean, you get some people who know what they're doing.
Exactly.
Right?
And I'm just absorbing from them all day when I'm there. And I'm so lucky to be there. So then I take that back to Chapstick and I'm like, how can we make this the next level up and kind of follow in these people's footsteps?
What's the end game here? I mean, because here comes season two and you guys were able to fundraise for it, which is great. And we're going to see, and you have cultivated an audience for the web series. Is the goal, I mean, in the sort of traditional sense, to send this out west and get people interested and see if a CISO or other places would be interested in producing, if not this, something else that you two work on? Mm.
Yeah, I definitely think that would be, you know, a goal, an amazing thing to happen. This will definitely be, you know, in our portfolios. If someone wants to pick it up specifically, that would be fantastic. If not, I mean, we have a great thing to show with a lot of material.
Yeah, I mean, that would be so great if that happened. And we will try, you know. I would think it would be cool for us to shoot, you know, a 30-minute pilot or, you know, put together a sizzle reel and try to pitch it to some networks. But it's pretty hard, you know, to get into those rooms to make those right connections. So as much as we can say, oh, my God, that would be the dream and that's what we want, you can wait for that, or you can continue to make work and hope that eventually you get to the level where you actually deserve a show. Because I don't know if we deserve a show yet, but I hope someday.
Spoken like a true EP,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, right. But I hope we get to that place someday where, you know, people want to work with us so badly like that.
Charlotte Kennett and Kearney Fagan in studio, their web series called Chapstick. You can find it online, Chapstick web series. You know, my last question for you guys, I mean, graduation is right here, right? I mean, you guys are going to be at the Auditorium Theater next week, right?
Yeah.
Or this weekend.
This Saturday.
Yes.
What's next? What are you going to do? I mean, is the plan to stay in Chicago? I mean, you're Columbia College students. Give us a glimpse of what two creative, filmmakers and actors, actresses want to do with their career.
Yeah.
I love Chicago. I love Chicago a lot. I've, lived by here my whole life. But I would love to move someplace warm, like LA. I think that that's where the film TV biz is. And if
are you going to do that? Are you doing it?
I think, yeah.
Are you telling the world now you're moving to LA?
Eventually. I don't know right away. But
yeah. What are you going to do when you get there?
Be poor.
Yeah, live on the
intern.
Side of the road.
I know. Now the real conversation starts.
Yeah.
We got the talk of the web series out of the way. I'm intrigued. Like, as
That's why I would just like to apply for some, fellowships and stuff
I
go. And Charlotte's on that.
Yeah, I'm doing that right now. Cause,
so you're online. You're, trying to apply for things in L.A.
Yeah, I'm applying to, a bunch of fellowships right now. And it's been intense. I'm writing spec scripts for Broad City. And I'm writing my original hour dramas and half-hour comedy series. And I'm loving it so much. It's just... It's also hard to know what they're exactly looking for. And you got to have your own voice, but you're also but what do they need? And I have to mold to this show. So for me, I will be moving to LA sooner, I think, than Kearney, because I'm ready to just jump in. But I know she'll be joining me and we'll continue to rock it. And maybe we'll come up with another show and have more connections to pitch it in a room where someone could
actually make it. Well, I can't wait. you both have to come back and tell us how life in LA is.
Yeah.
When you guys are we don't do interviews, we're so big.
Oh, come
on. You have to come back to the download. That's
Justin,
the one
we'll
thing.
Come back.
All right, good. Charlotte Kennett, Kearney Fagan, two Columbia College students graduating this weekend are the creators behind the web series Chapstick. Season one is out. They're recording and producing season two as we speak. Thanks both for being in studio tonight. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Justin.
Doesn't love a little Richmond, Illinois, huh? I remember a story about Richmond. I grew up right in Wonder Lake there, right? Not too far. Richmond, I believe it's Route 31 goes right through there. It's 31 I think it's 31. 12. You know what? I'm losing my mind. Anyway, the story I remember, and this was years after, it was they have a problem because they're a border town to Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Right on the border.
Mm-hmm.
And so the allegiances over whether they're Packers fans or Bears fans is really intense there. Not unlike the stories we heard when the Bears played the Colts. They talked about Northwest Indiana, who do you go for?
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that what cable package is offered? Do you get Sunday Packer games or Sunday Bear games? And you don't get to choose. So I remember this a couple years ago. It was maybe now it's 15 years ago. I remember the story was that the mayor's we're a Packer town. So the Comcast there or whatever would show Packer games, because that's the local team, even though it was Illinois. And the Bears fans were uh-uh. Can you imagine that? Your town being divided down the line like that?
Yeah, I wouldn't
probably,
like it.
Probably bigger social issues that divide towns than what football team you're into, but...
Probably.
Probably. But yeah, I remember that being a thing in Richmond.
It seems like in this day and age... That wouldn't be a problem.
It still is. My dad lives and gets DirecTV, and he gets it out of they live outside of Lake Geneva. And so all of it is Milwaukee Television. And so because it's Milwaukee Television, the rules still apply that they get Milwaukee area sports. So for instance, because he can get Comcast Chicago, but it'll black out.
Oh, it'll black out the
Blackhawks or Bulls. Yeah. One of the teams, he tells me, it blacks out. And the Bears, too. Bears are only on when the Packers aren't. If the Packers are on Monday Night Football,
Bears will be out.
Right. So, yeah, there you go. So just a little tidbit, a little cable TV tidbit for you tonight in a download.
I guess I think I've been in situations where I've been traveling in a hotel or in Michigan or something, and I want to watch the Bears game and they have the Lions.
You automatically think it's on at noon. Simon was saying, we Chicagoans just think everything revolves around us. And we're what is this? No Bears. Bears are playing the Titans.
I spent a good half an hour making fun of their local news team, whatever city I'm in, and then I move on to football.
Your wife's like, can we go to dinner? You're like, no, I need to do my due diligence and make fun of the 10 o'clock news team. All right, coming up here on the Download Studio 435, Lily Kay in studio. Very excited to have her back on the Download performing live tonight. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer. Tonight, no exception, we welcome jazz and soul singer Lily Kay in studio.
Hey.
Lily just released her second studio album, Magic, at the end of last year. She's a Chicago staple, worked with several Chicago musicians, including her band and her producers like Peter Cottontail, hip-hop artists like Chance the Rapper, Vic Mensa, just to name a few. Lily Kay is here tonight. She's doing a residency every Tuesday night in May at the Alice in the lobby of the Soho Hotel, and also doing a tribute to Ella Fitzgerald on May 31st at Untitled. Lily Kay, welcome to the show. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
So we're excited. We're going to hear some live music tonight. Last time we talked, you were here right around Thanksgiving time. We talked about Magic coming out. How's it been? How has the record been received? How do you feel, you know, having a couple months under your belt when it comes to putting out new music?
It's been fun. You know, we kind of rushed putting that out just because the timing felt so perfect. You know, the song being about women being magical in the face of misogyny. And, you know, it was going on in November. And so
still going on today.
It's still going on now. But so, yeah, that's why we kind of rushed to put that one out. And I got a great response. Different like rape crisis centers and domestic violence centers shared it. Violent studies programs at universities really? Shared the video. It was really awesome to see like that powerful
was that,
of a response.
Was that something that you thought was possible? Like that was, that was going to be a part of the music? Because you put out a song that was, and we talked about Magic last time you were on, just sort of like an empowerment song that was really going after the feel of the country at the time right after the election. But I mean, yeah, but the idea of this being accepted by, like you said, different places and communities and universities, things like that, that's something
that's
different
like
for a soul singer.
Definitely the highest honor I think I could achieve. It's, you know, we as creatives, we love just making our art and it's fun and it's our passion. But I don't think anything feels as good as really knowing that your music has helped someone or has impacted somebody in a positive way. And so that's why it was so crazy to have, you know, these legitimate centers that help women thinking my art could help other women.
I mean, that's not the whole album. The whole album is, you know, you got a lot of different stuff on there. But the obviously that being the single, and we'll hear that tonight as well, the track Magic. I mean, it really, I mean, to see your success and to have shows, you know, around that. And like you just talked about the universities and the different community agencies and things that are supporting you. I mean, think about, it's interesting as an artist, you can have message in the music.
Yeah.
And that's something that you don't necessarily see that much with jazz and soul singers. I mean, it's a lot of party music. It's a lot of improv music. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a lot of love songs.
Yeah.
But there's not going to be much in the genre of besides civil rights. I mean, civil rights, of course, with civil Curtis Mayfield, people like that. But in this day and age, you don't see that as much. So it is a little bit of a step out.
Yeah. And I think it kind of pays homage to the origins of jazz. You know, it was kind of viewed as the more revolutionary genre of its time. You know, it was illegal to play in certain places. And so I think it's always kind of been a form of protest music. And I just think it's important that especially when, you know, every day we see such terrible things happening and terrible people doing terrible things. And it's like, what can we do? Like this, you know, we all have our own thing in our life that we do, whether it's working at a bank or whether it's, you know, having your own web series or anything. Like we all have a chance to make a positive impact. And so I think whether it's as small as having a conversation with somebody or writing a song about a topic that really matters to you, I think it's really important now more than ever to kind of use whatever we have to fight for a better world for everyone.
You know, I say jazz and soul, and there's obviously a crossover there. Which comes first for you? I mean, do you consider yourself first a jazz singer? I mean, talk about how you got into jazz.
Yeah, well, jazz was when I came up mainly with like gospel and Motown. That's what my mom kind of raised me on. A little bit of classic rock as well. And I was always surrounded by these giant, huge, booming voices, which I loved, but I didn't really have myself. And the first time I heard jazz, I was around 11 or 12, and it just made sense to me. That was like, oh, that's what my voice is. That's what my voice sounds like. I heard Ella Fitzgerald, and it just clicked. So I, as far as my voice goes, I think I have a jazz voice, but I've been so influenced by gospel and soul and funk and rock and, you know, so many genres.
Yeah, right.
And so that's what's really cool about our new project is we kind of went into it without any genre in mind. And so we just wanted to create without boundaries. And it's not just me, it's my band and I writing this whole project. So you don't only have my influences, you have all of their influences. And we all have pretty similar tastes. You know, we decided to be in a group together. But we all have, you know, very different stories and different backgrounds. And it's really cool to kind of throw everything together and see what we came up
with. When you approach a project like that, where you say, no genre, we're not going to do the genre, we're going to go in there and we'll start working on this music. Do you find yourself falling into to old patterns? Meaning sort of like you start to approach it as a soul singer and you're like, wait, we're not doing just soul music. I mean,
Not necessarily, but I think sometimes I have to remind myself, like, it's okay to be outside of the box. You know, because I do songwriting for other people as well. And sometimes, you know, you write this thing, you're like, oh, this is a little too pop for this. So I don't know, this is a little too edgy for this. It's like, oh, I don't have to do that. I don't have to check myself here. I can just create.
Right.
And it's also awesome because, you know, as working in a group, it's easy for us to kind of snap each other out of bad habits or be like, no, that's weird, but go for it. It's really cool.
How is it as an artist? I've always been admired people who can write music for other people as a career, as a job, and be able to create and produce their own music as well. How do you talk about that experience and how you sort of separate them so that one is work and one is passion?
Yeah, they're just totally different experiences. So when I write for myself, it's very personal. I can not be afraid to say certain things. You know, it's my art form. And when I write for myself, I don't necessarily sit down and say, okay, I'm going to write a song today. I more so let it come to me. So sometimes I'll write a song in 5 minutes, and sometimes it'll take me 3 months to find like what I want to do for a bridge for a song. When I'm writing for other people, I kind of look at it more as like a puzzle. And so it's like, okay, I make up almost a whole scenario in my head, and I can, or sometimes I think of like a love movie, say it's a love song, and I think of a love story that in a movie I like, and I write a song about that story. And so it's more just figuring it out, and it's like a game, and it's really, really fun. But that's how I'm able to separate it, so I can save my personal stuff for me. And then
You the kind of writer who writes a song and submits it and says, this is for you, take it? Or are you the kind of writer who has the musician part of you also have to play, you have to play with the musicians you're writing for?
I think it's always fun to work hands-on with whatever artist ends up doing that song. And like, I'm still fairly new to this writing for other people thing. So I don't have the most experience in the world with which I prefer, cause I've done both.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's cool too, to kind of, you write this kind of outline of a song for somebody, and then you send it off and you're able to see what their artistry does with it, which is also really cool, especially when you're writing for artists admire. And then you hear what they do with it and you're like, oh my God, you're so good. I'm so happy you are singing this song. But then it's also cool to, be hands on with somebody and kind of help them execute the vision you had.
I know a couple people who are songwriters who also write their own stuff. And the only takeaway that I ever hear from them is that the hours are just crazy. Like that you essentially start at midnight and you roll till 6.
Enjoy writing in the middle of the night. I've had a lot of great day sessions in my life. I think that's totally not the way it has to be. Every once in a while we have all night sessions. But I mean, even with our album, we wrote most of everything during the day. You know, in bed by 11, not by 11, but you know, get home in time, make some dinner, hang out,
Your time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Lily Kay is in studio. She's jazz and soul singer here in Chicago. Her album is called Magic. She's going to perform the title track coming up here in just a moment. We'll take a quick break. We'll sound check. We'll get the band ready to go, and we will have live music in studio 435 here on The Download. Stay with us. Tonight on WGN-TV, Mark Sapelsa takes you inside the mind of a neo-Nazi. WGN-TV investigates tonight at 9. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. What do we got? Myron's got an ish with the drums. Bob's checking it out. Studio 435. our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer. Tonight, in studio, jazz and soul singer Lily Kay with the Lily Kay Band. Myron Cherry and Cullen Bogan in studio. Phil and Matthew not here tonight, so it's a three-piece. I need to correct myself. I said the album was called Magic. It's Planet of Flowers. Sorry about that, Lily. The track is called Magic, the title or the single off the record. We're going to hear that now. Right now, there's a residency every Tuesday night in May at the Alice in the lobby of the Soho Hotel. Also a tribute to Ella Fitzgerald on May 31st at Untitled. We'll be hearing more about Ella a little bit later in the show. But right now, Studio 435, here is the Lily Kay Band with Magic.
Your midriff showing my how daring. I can't help it, don't be selfish. Tell you to smile, don't be a bit about it. Do as I say, on your back delay. Take it in your dress like you wanted it anyway. Don't you cry or say you lied, but believe my sign, cause I'm the guy. Now you see, that's the type of shit that weak, pathetic boys try. Try to dim a light. I said a woman is magic. A woman gave you
band in studio here. Cullen Bogan, Myron Cherry as well. Myron on the drums, Cullen on the guitar. Of course, Lily Kay on the vocals. The track Magic off the album Planet of Flowers. You can see Lily every Tuesday night in May at the Alice in the lobby of the Soho Hotel on Green Street in the West Loop. Also, she'll be doing a tribute to Ella Fitzgerald on May 31st at Untitled. We'll have more here in Studio 435 with Lily Kay and the Lily Kay Band here on The Download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. We'll be right back. All right, more with Lily K coming up here on the Download, Studio 435. Just heard the track Magic coming up. We'll hear some new stuff and tribute to Ella Fitzgerald. How fun will that be? She's got the big show tributing Ella up on May 31st at Untitled. And then also she is in residency at the Alice in the Soho House lobby every Tuesday in May. So there you go. Coming up here after the news. This is Chicago's very own 720 WG in Chicago. It's Download. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio, Studio 435 tonight. Lily K and the Lily K Band. That is Lily K, Cullen Bogan, Myron Cherry. We just heard a little bit of their work, the track Magic off the album Planet of Flowers. Lily K, are you? Is the whole band there at the Alice? Are you guys all at the?
At the Alice is actually just Cullen and I doing acoustic.
Just the two of us.
That is and that is at the Soho Hotel on Tuesday nights, and then you're doing a tribute to Ella Fitzgerald on May 31st at Untitled.
Yeah,
as well.
And that's actually a trio show with the three of us.
All right, there we go.
Just the three of you.
All right, so let's talk about. I mean, what I'm interested in. You guys talked, Lily. You talked a little bit about the idea of sort of coming to the music without genre, and when you're working with musicians, especially when you guys are in collaborative form. Let's talk to the band a little bit about what are the challenges of doing that, Cullen? Like the idea of trying to clear your mind of a certain specific sound or genre that you're going for and just sort of work off each other.
Well, for me, actually, when I work with Lily, I have something in mind, like, oh, I want to do like this genre or this genre. And then I work with her and it just doesn't go that route.
It always changes.
You know? So I'll be listening to a record like, oh, I want to do like something that's more dancey for this one, and then
it doesn't work
at the end of the session. No. It's like that's not where this is going.
I feel like we give it an effort, yeah, but then the song just takes a life of its own.
Yeah, because a lot of times it's me and Lily working like the initial thoughts, and then the rest of the band comes in and changes it.
Well, I mean, that's a good,
in a good way. In a
that's
good,
a good nice. Question. I mean, how often does a collaboration flower into a song, and how much of it is sort of like, well, that was a good session, guys, but we're not going to use any of it?
A good amount of the time, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more, it's like, oh, okay, well, we didn't get anything today. We'll get back to it later. Mm-hmm. And then there's situations where we're like beating a dead horse.
Like just trying to make a song work and it just doesn't work.
Trying and trying. And then all of a sudden it just happens like over time. Over.
Lily, how much do you guys take, how much do you all take from the sort of components of jazz, the idea of improvisation and trying to start something for fresh, you know, just sort of like you guys all collaborating in the moment, as opposed to coming in with a structure and sort of working out the arrangement of a song?
I personally say that is the sole basis of how we even get things together. Like, we'll just be like, okay, so I'll just play this and see what happens. It's like one of the songs, like me and Cullen were writing some things together, and I was just like, yeah, I should play a beat that goes like this. And then Cullen was like, oh, well, I can put this over it. And then all of a sudden, after they got together and after other people heard it, it was like, oh, this actually turned into
something.
Like,
yeah, right? It's like layering almost,
yeah,
right?
We've also, sometimes if we do like jam sessions, Myron records them all the time, like, you know, live performance jam sessions. Right, and so we'll listen back and see if we have any ideas that we can turn into songs.
We used one of them.
We used one of them for the album. Mm-hmm.
That's
really
great.
Cool.
I love that process. That's a process where you can go back and you can edit and you can sit as together. You can say, you know, you give each other ideas, things like that.
Yeah.
I recommend that to all artists.
It's so cool. There's actually one song. It's the next song we're performing, actually. Myron and I started writing it like 2 years ago and then completely abandoned it. And Cullen and I were in a writing session one day, and he remembered my melody from it, and then we turned it into a whole song. Yeah, you did. He's shaking his head that he didn't. No, he was like, do you remember that one song? And it turned into a whole song, and he was like, I'd never thought we would make a song out of this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah.
How, I mean,
see, we don't even remember.
I mean, you guys, you mentioned earlier, I mean, the idea that you could do a lot of this production for this record in the daytime, you know, as opposed to nighttime. How much of your life is music? I mean, are you the guys all musicians who just do music all day and night, and you don't have any other sort of day job or anything that gets in the way of it?
Yeah, it's like 26/12. That's how. Yeah, it's no, 24/7 doesn't exist in my world. It's right. Like 20/20/20, like all the time, every time. It's like weird parts of the night, 3 a.m. I'm up. Like, oh, yes, I have an idea, or I'm laying in bed with my iPad or something like that.
And to be a musician, a working musician, I mean, does that mean you take on just a ton of different gigs to play drums? Or, I mean, how does it work?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but I mean, that's, I mean, for people at home listening going, oh, these guys are full-time musicians, that doesn't necessarily mean the three of you are.
Oh, we're not like the Lily
Kay
band is.
Yeah,
no,
I mean,
like,
you guys are working musicians, you're playing in different bands, right?
Yeah, like I was just in Michigan over the weekend, and then coming back from Michigan, I went straight to church.
Yeah.
And then I had a rehearsal after that, and then, you know, came home, worked on some ideas, put together some arrangements for another group, you know.
Yeah, right.
Woke up today, worked more ideas.
Yeah. That's that Chicago hustle.
Yeah.
But what's kind of cool about this group in particular is, like, when we get together, it's like we're all kind of writing together, and it's become our group. And I've never wanted it to just be like, oh, I have some musicians playing for me. That's never the vision I had in mind for my band.
And that has to be a big part of the collaboration. I mean, for you guys to be able to get together, like you said, Myron, and be able to do this kind of style where you sort of layer, that does have some ownership to it in the sense that it's not just one musician coming in with their vision and everyone else plays.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Lily Kay and the Lily Kay Band in studio. The album, the latest album, Planet of Flowers. We just heard Magic. What are we going to hear? This is new work?
Yeah, this is a brand new exclusive. It's called Argue.
Argue.
Yes.
All right.
And this will be our first time ever performing.
All right. All right. I'll I'll let you guys get up to your instruments, and I will talk you up there. Cullen Bogan, Myron Cherry, and Lily Kay are the Lily Kay Band. Of course, the album I just mentioned was Planet of Flowers. We heard the track Magic. Now we're going to hear a new song from them called Argue. Lily Kay is in residence at the Alice in the lobby of the Soho Hotel every Tuesday, and she's going to be doing a tribute to Ella Fitzgerald coming up on May 31st at Untitled. We're going to hear a little Ella tribute coming up. Our last performance here at Studio 435. Like I said, they're getting to their instruments, Lily Kay and the Lily Kay Band. Here is the track Argue. Take it away, guys.
Well,
Lily Kay and the Lily Kay Band here in Studio 435 in our Allstate Showcase studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. And the song Argue, brand new song, her latest album, Planet of Flowers. And she will be in residence. She continues to be in residence at the Alice in the lobby of the Soho Hotel on Tuesday nights. She's also doing a tribute to Ella Fitzgerald on May 31st at Untitled. We will hear a little of the tribute coming up here right after the break. Studio 435, stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN, Studio 435, Lily Kay and the Lily Kay Band, jazz soul singer whose last studio album, Planet of Flowers, is out. You can see her every Tuesday night at the Alice in the lobby of the Soho Hotel, and she'll be doing a tribute to Ella Fitzgerald on May 31st at Untitled. Talk about Ella. Let's talk about this tribute, because we're going to hear something here before we wrap up the show. What does Ella mean to you?
Ella is my favorite vocalist of all time. When I first heard her, that's when my voice finally made sense to me, and I just think she's the queen of phrasing and range, and just her versions of all the standards are just so good. I love her.
It's as a musician who, you know, does tribute work to her, I mean, is it tough to put that stuff together? I mean, I think of her as sort of like,
I mean, it's intimidating because she's so good, but you know, I've been listening to her since I was a wee little thing. And so I have some of her scat solos memorized, and we kind of do odes by that way. But it's still jazz, so we don't want to completely just copy it. We want to kind of take it and make it our own, but use songs that she has just phenomenal renditions.
What are we going to hear here?
Tonight we are going to do Round Midnight.
All right, Round Midnight. Lily Kay and the Lily Kay Band, Cullen Bogan, Myron Cherry in studio with Lily Kay. The album Planet of Flowers. Here is the tribute to Ella Fitzgerald. She'll be doing the tribute on May 31st at Untitled, but here is Round Midnight. Take it away, guys.
It begins to tell around midnight. I do pretty well. The left out, sundown, supper time, I'm feeling sad, I'll see. But it really gets bad around midnight. Mary's always done around midnight. Haven't got the heart to stand those memories. When my heart is still with you, and on midnight knows it too. When some quarrel we had needs mending. Does that mean that our love is ending? Oh, darling, I need you, Lately I find that I'm out of your heart, and I'm out of my mind. So let our love take wing. Around midnight, let the angels sing for your returning, till my heart is safe and
feel like I'm in a jazz club. I love it. Studio 435. Lily Kay and the Lily Kay Band. That was Round Midnight. I would say that you're ode to Ella
My
Fitzgerald.
Ode to Ella.
Ode to My Ella. Queen. The tribute to Ella Fitzgerald will be on May 31st at Untitled, just right around the corner from our studio. She can be seen in the Alice, the lobby of the Soho Hotel every Tuesday night. Her album Planet of Flowers, the band Cullen Bogan, Myron Cherry, and of course Lily Kay. I can't thank you guys enough. Thanks for coming in and performing tonight and being guests in Studio 435.